This is Dental Smith, October 2, 1963. We abstract whenever we receive, observe, or sense in any way. We abstract when we say what we have seen, when we talk about what we have observed or experienced in any way. We abstract when we talk about what we have said, commenting on it, evaluating it, revising it, explaining it, etc. So we abstract whenever we judge or form opinions or attitudes, including prejudices, likes and dislikes, or make theories, and I want to talk now about abstracting in a more or less systematic and organized fashion. So let's have a slide, and here it is. We may not get beyond this slide at all today. I want to begin by talking about the overall picture very briefly, and then go back and pick it up part by part and develop the details somewhat. This is designed to be a diagram of the process of abstracting which we carry on in the nervous system continuously. We can talk about it as though it could be broken down into levels. Notice my language. I say we can. We can talk about it in this way. We can talk about it in other ways, too. We can talk about it as though it were to be broken down into levels. You may prefer to talk about it in other ways. Our language and the way we use it are very arbitrary. It is, in the final analysis, up to us what we say and how we say it. So we can talk about the abstracting process in a certain way, if we prefer, and I prefer to. It is easiest to understand, I think, if we begin with this level, which we call the level of simple sensing. The naked eye or naked nose, the naked tongue or naked ear level. The level at which all forms of life abstract. If you were to diagram the process of abstracting of your dog over here, you would draw a circle, and that would represent the level of simple sensing for the dog, mostly of sniffing. And that's about all you would draw. That would pretty well represent the process of abstracting of Fido. We'll come back to Fido after a while. I think it is terribly important to understand the difference in the abstracting processes of yourself and of your pets, the forms of life. Now, we do not obviously see everything that is to be seen. We do not hear everything that is to be heard, as we've already noted. The eye can respond or can abstract only a small part of the total life spectrum. The ear can abstract or respond to only a small part of the whole spectrum of vibration. Some vibrations, as you know, can tear you apart. We can hear only a small part of all of the range of vibration. And so for all of the rest of the sensory modes. we abstract in the sense that we can respond only to a limited part of what there is going on. But we can develop lenses, magnification instruments, hearing aids, high-speed photography. We can develop chemical analyses that enable us to see what we could not otherwise see. And so we have various ways of extending the range of the abstracting capacity of the eye or ear or any other of the sensory end organs, the abstracting mechanisms at the sensory level. So I coined the word to enable us to refer to this kind of abstracting. I call it lensing. I think we need a word like this because there is a very important distinction to be made between the observation which would be non-lensing behavior and that which would involve lensing. By lensing, I mean, I will come back to this later to develop it much more, but for the moment, I mean the use of any kind of means, facilities to extend the abstracting capacity or potential of yourself, of the observer, that is. I'm lensing when I wear glasses. When I don't wear them, I don't see as much as I do when I wear them. We lens with microscopes, telescopes, high-speed photography, etc. I want just to mention a favorite belief, and it is my own opinion to be evaluated by you as such. In my judgment, by all odds, the very most important invention in all of human history was the lens. Far more important than the wheel or the lever, far more important, I think, than the printing press. The lens, because it made possible the observation of phenomena which had been overlooked, which had not been taken into account at all. And so all conclusions drawn before the lens potentially had to be revised after the lens. And so the lens forced a very great intellectual reform, if you like. And I think that it is no accident that the lens was developed historically in relation to the Renaissance. The Renaissance essentially followed the introduction of the lens. And in my judgment, the lens was probably the most important single factor which brought about this great change, which we recognize by names such as the Renaissance or the Scientific Revolution, so on. What was more important than the data which the use of the telescope and the microscope in the 16th century resulted in, the data, the specific data, which was observed and reported by people like Galileo and Leeuwenhoek, these were not as important as the fact of the use of the lens at all. It was the lensing that was important. It was the fact that a new dimension had been introduced into human thought and experience. And it has been the development of that dimension which has resulted in the modern world, as I see it. The development of the lensing behavior. A lenser is a person who seeks new information, who tries deliberately to discover what has not been known before. He values new data more than he values old conclusions or beliefs. A non-lenser values old beliefs and conclusions more than new data. He is afraid of new data. He feels somehow threatened by it. And there's a great gulf between these two ways of approaching the world and life. Well, perhaps that's enough to underscore the point, and we'll come back to it and talk much more about it. But to get on with the process of abstracting, even with the most high-powered means that we can develop, or have developed, for viewing, for observing, we assume, we have learned to assume, I think is the way to say it, we have learned to assume that we cannot possibly exhaust all there is to be known. We cannot observe everything. To make a simple statement of it, you just can't see everything. So what do you do about this? We discover all we can. It seems to be what we do. We discover all we can through observation. And then we make up, we imagine what there must be, the beables, what might be to account for what we see. I have tried to explain this in the text, especially by reference to the development of the molecular theory of matter, which came about when the Scottish botanist Brown, a little over 100 years ago, he was working one day with pollen grains in a microscope, observed that the pollen grains, which he had placed suspended in a droplet of liquid water, were moving fitfully, continuously. And he couldn't understand the movement. He thought there was something wrong with the microscope, that perhaps the table was unsteady, or that they were having an earthquake, or the wind was doing it. He couldn't understand this. This was the first time in the world that anyone had ever observed this, which has come to be called the Brownian movement. It is the movement, the constant movement of small particles suspended in another medium. It can be seen in smoke or in small particles of solid suspended in a liquid, as he was observing it. The attempt to account for the Brownian movement has resulted in the development of modern theoretical physics, the molecular theory of matter, as a result, which in the simplest terms holds that there are tiny particles, there must be, would be the way you would say it in simple language. There must be tiny particles, and very many of them, moving at high velocities, bombarding the pollen grains, or bombarding the other particles that are large enough to see. And that accounts for the movement of them. It's not such a very wild idea once you In fact, it doesn't take much imagination. It's probably the least imaginative kind of a theory you could have. The theory of the brownies is much more imaginative. That are brownies who are shaking the waters of it. It's much more imaginative. This is about the least imaginative theory you could develop, it seems to me. All you do is just to extrapolate what you already know, what you're already looking at. You're looking at particles and they're moving. So you imagine other particles that are moving. Ever since then, men concerned with such matters have been exercising their imagination. Until now, we have ever so many kinds of particles, very theoretical forms of wave phenomena, so on, all on this level. You see, nobody has ever observed an electron, a meson, only things are imagined here, and given qualities and characteristics of such a kind as to account for what we see. And so we can call this the level of the beables, what might be. The submicroscopic level of abstracting, if you want to get technical, as I think I do in the book. This is the level of supposing, of imagining what might be to account for what we can see by lensing or by simple sensing. These are all nonverbal levels of abstracting. Presumably we abstract from this level from what there must be to be abstracted from. And on this level, we abstract from this level. That is, we see more details on this level by means of microscopes and whatnot, high-speed photography. We see more than we do on the level of simple sensing with the naked eye, the naked ear, etc. And so there's an abstracting process in the usual sense of that word. That is, you are leaving out details as you go up the levels of abstracting. Now we come to verbal levels, and you can have as many verbal levels as I have tried to suggest by these dotted lines, which I have interspersed with the others. I try to suggest that your ingenuity is the only limit to how many levels you want to differentiate in terms of verbal abstracting. And for most purposes, I think one can say most of what there is to be said if we differentiate out these levels, which I have tried to describe with these terms. So we have the level of describing, the language used for describing. And this language is designed primarily to represent differences between or among what there is to be observed or imagined. And so when we describe, we enumerate differences. A good diagnostician tries to observe all the ways in which the individual patient is now observing is different from any other patient he ever saw. And the more thorough he is, the more unlike any other patient he has ever seen, this patient will appear to be. I've indicated that on this level of language, we differentiate. We break things down into differences. In the ultimate form, we use numbers. And on the number scale, the number line that you learn about in elementary algebra, There is a point for every number. And so you can differentiate as just as finely as you care to on the level of the most descriptive language that we could manage. In the ultimate, it would be isomorphic. That is to say, for every word, there would be an abstraction on the nonverbal level to go with it. Every word would refer to one and only one abstraction, or experience, or observation, or perception. Well, obviously, our language is not that finely differentiating. Even on the lowest descriptive levels, our language tends to be pretty lumpy, pretty crude. It's a very defective instrument, as I hope we will be highly aware of by the time we get done with the course. You will begin to wonder, how could you ever have been able to communicate at all with such a poorly developed instrument as our language? To represent what amounts to an infinity of experiences, of realities, of phenomena, we have a very limited number of words. You probably have a vocabulary measured in terms of the words which you are able to recognize of maybe 100,000 words. It's hard to say what it would be exactly. But you say from a half to three-fourths of everything you say with 100 different words. And with those 100 words, you are trying to represent this complex world you live in. These 100 words represent from a half to three-fourths of all that you say about this complex world you live in and the complex life you live in it. No wonder you're misunderstood and confused. There's such a lack of relationship between our words and whatever we mean by reality. We tend mainly to talk on this level of classifying. And the language we use for classifying is designed to represent resemblances, how things are alike, how they do not differ. And so this is the level of categorical judgment. We talk about what people are. That is, in what group are they to be classified? We lump our experiences into big groupings. And these groupings, the words representing the groupings, tend to be charged. We not only classify, we evaluate. That is, some of the classifications are good and some are bad as we evaluate them. Some are normal and others are abnormal. Some are desirable and others are undesirable. There are the we and the they, us and them, and so forth. My time's about up and I want to paint the picture and we'll come back to it. On this level, we explain. One of the most intriguing lines I ever heard was Oppenheimer's statement when he said, what we don't understand, we explain to each other. And by means of this kind of a diagram, we would say, what we don't understand, pointing to these levels, look, eyes up. You're not looking. What we don't understand, we explain to each other. On the level of explanation, we talk about relations. What goes with what? what came first and what next, what came together, what goes with what, and how come. And so we talk about what might be to account for, to explain what we observe and describe and classify. Now we explain it by talking about what might be. And so here, talking about this, talking on this level, about this level, we use words like habit. Nobody has ever seen a habit, but there might be habits to account for the orderliness or the consistency with which persons do certain things. No one has ever seen an ego, but we say there might be an ego, and he might be fighting with something else which we will call the id. Let's just call it that. Let's call it something. Nobody's ever seen one anyway. And so on this level, we talk about what might possibly be to account for the funny things people do. Here you have words like electrons and molecules and neutrons. And here also you have words like luck and faith and so forth and so on. And now we'll come back to this, and there's lots to say about the implications of that. And now I must go and talk to the Department of Agriculture.